Is that the first thing we're considering?
Calling State Affairs to order, 3:19 p.m., Thursday, February 22nd, 2018, in the Max Gruenberg Room. Will the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Knopf?
Here.
Representative Wolf?
Here.
Representative Kopp, Aldernet, Representative Ledoux?
Here.
Representative Birch?
Here.
Representative Johnson? Representative Tuck? Representative
Joseph Alderman, Chair Price Tompkins. Here. And with five members present, we have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you, Martha. Thank you, Ben, today for facilitating. We have one, two, three items on today's agenda. First hearing of HGR 27 from Representative Quito. We have a first hearing for House Bill 310 relating to marriage and minimum age for marriage from Representative Clayman. And then we have our fourth hearing on HB 152, and as noticed on Tuesday, it's my intent for there to be committee action. There's also a CS on this piece of legislation, and it's my understanding that the sponsor's office has been in touch with members of the committee on that subject. To the first item on today's agenda, HJR 27 from Representative Quito, please come forward, and staff, Ms. Ellis, put yourself on the record and present the legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, members of the committee. Thank you for hearing HJR 27. And I will provide a bit of a presentation, and we can have some questions and a little bit of dialogue. Basically, this idea came about, and I know it's been proposed by others in the past in different forms in the past. But as I attended National Conference of State Legislatures this year, spent time in a session on term limits and started thinking about the issue with respect to Alaska, and was thinking we are at a crossroads and have been for probably close to 10 years now, where we have been operating in between kind of a citizen legislature and a full-time legislature. And one of the things that I think clearly defines a citizen legislature is having citizens that actually have jobs and careers, have experience outside the legislature that they can bring, or have roles that they can play during the interim that allows them to have experiences outside of the professional lawmaking arena. And we haven't seen a lot of that here in the state of Alaska, and I think we do in some respects end up with an idea that people become career politicians. And I had a career in engineering before I started this job, and was thinking that I wanted to do this job for a while and then go off and do something else perhaps before I retire. But I was thinking the ideas that I'm bringing in, if I am here for 20 years, then this has become my career, and that the ideas I can bring are no longer going to be fresh and relevant. And so I thought from a perspective, and I guess being an engineer trying to solve problems, the first thing that I do is remove myself from the problem. And I thought, what would our state look like with a legislature that had a regular influx of new ideas and fresh interest in the legislative process? And I actually came to the personal conclusion that I thought it would be a good idea that if we're going to have a true citizen legislature, that we provide an opportunity for new people to come in. And we do actually have fairly good circulation within our legislature. We did some research and identified that at least in the other body, probably an average 10-year, some shorter, some significantly longer, of about 9 years. And in the House of Representatives, an average 10-year of slightly over 7 years. And so looking at that and looking at, well, if we want to try and have the regular infusion and not just a big switchover, which is kind of how our legislature works, we have major changes in the years following a reapportionment, and we end up with a new group of legislators that come in. In some years we've had two elections with a reapportionment and then another change, and then we have another flow of people coming in. Seemed to me that it would make sense as a citizen legislature and not a full-time legislature to provide those opportunities for individuals to provide some public service to the state of Alaska as a legislator, step aside, and then somebody else comes in and brings their ideas in as well. And this is not a prohibition on serving. It actually, way it lays out the in the constitutional amendment is it says that you can serve up to four terms in the House of Representatives, up to two terms in the Senate, before either taking a two-year break from the body you're in or switching to another body would allow or could allow for 16 years of continuous service or longer if you go from the House to the Senate and back. And we do have one example of a legislator that has done that in the past. And so we do have situations where those kinds of things have happened. But I think it keeps the ideas in the bodies fresh. And one of the other things that I did look through, NCSL has done a report on term limits, kind of an inconclusive, but a lot of great information. And so the information I was able to collect out of that report basically said that one of the reasons for not having term limits was so people could build up the experience as, say, a chair of a committee or build their knowledge in leadership. I guess I think about our state and we as individual legislators representing approximately 20,000 individuals each. I don't understand why we as legislators need to have more experience than, say, a governor who is representing 700,000 Alaskans and administering all of the programs that our state provides. And we actually limit our governor to 2 4-year terms, to 8 years. And we believe as a state that that is adequate to provide for the leadership needed as a governor. Why then is it appropriate for a legislator to have significantly longer period of service? And as different than other states do have people that build up seniority, work their way through a vice chair or a chair. But as I was also looking at how the campaign or the committees operate within our legislature, generally we have a turnover in Senate President and Speaker of the House every 2 years. We have committee chairs that turn over for the most part every 2 years. We have had one situation with a speaker for 8 years. That's happened only once. And we have, as far as I know, I don't know that we've had too many speakers that have served more than one term as speaker. So we already, in a sense, are operating as if we have a term-limited legislature because we have an average length of service that is right around the 8 years, and we have turnover in the committees, so knowledge in a particular committee area doesn't appear to be as critical in our state, especially being a small state. So why not provide that opportunity for other Alaskans to participate? And I guess the other choice, in my opinion, is that we then either not have a full citizen legislature where individuals bring their own experience or have experiences in during the interim or in their lives that they bring to the table. We need to start looking at the possibility of a full-time legislature paying our legislators a full-time salary and then expecting them to do full-time work, in which case we would end up with people with 20-plus year careers in public service. So with that, I've got a little bit over what the bill does, but tried to provide an explanation for my rationale for wanting to put this forward. And basically, it's a resolution that provides a ballot initiative or a ballot proposition that would be voted on by the people of Alaska. And if Alaskans don't agree that we need to be term limited, then they can deny that. And there was an election back in 1998 where a similar question that was more advisory was put on the ballot. And it did succeed, succeeded by a small margin. So it's not one of those things where it is as clearly defined as, say, congressional term limits. There was an election back in 1996 and then, or actually 1994 and then 1996. That were about congressional term limits. Both of those elections supported congressional term limits fairly strongly, but that issue was then nullified, in a sense, by Supreme Court action. So with that, I would entertain any questions and look forward to the discussion that we have on the issue.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I'm actually going to sneak in a really quick opening question. Do you happen to remember what the margin was for the 1998 advisory question?
It's in here.
For the record, this is Caitlin Ellis, staff to Representative Keto. The 1998 election was 50.2%. It was very close margins. The earlier ones, 1994 was almost 63% in favor of it. 1996 was 54.5%. These are both, those two were both about congressional limits. The 1998 one was much closer.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Birch, then Representative Knopf.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question. I've actually advocated for this at one time or another in the past, but we actually got dissuaded back in the day of Senator Ted Stevens and in the seniority and the benefits of seniority at the congressional level. Just recently celebrated the Dean of the House. That would be our lone congressman, who is now, I think, the longest-term congressman in history, but certainly seated today. So there are some advantages, certainly at a congressional level, for the seniority. We've seen it with Anwar opening and some of the other events that have happened. One of the things I'm struck by, though, and I'd ask your comments on it, is I'm in my second year of my first term in the legislature, and I'm one of 25 or 25% or one of 15 new members out of 60. So in the House, we've had a dozen people members turned over in the House and three in the Senate. So we have 15. So we have a 25% turnover in any business. 25% turnover is a pretty significant percentage, and I guess I'm struck by the fact that it seems like the voters are doing a pretty good job of limiting terms for those that are going to have their terms limited. So I'm struck by that. On the aspect of employment, I couldn't agree more, and I was deeply disappointed to get drugged back here four times in four special sessions under the heavy hand of special session construction, and that would decimate any the idea of having a job or maintaining a business or anything else, and so that is kind of a sidebar issue, but I guess why do we think we need to do a term limit if we have a 25% turnover in the body?
Representative Keto, before you answer, I just want to recognize Representative Tuck joined us about 5 minutes ago.
Thank you, Representative Chair Grace Tompkins, through the chair, Representative Birch. And I think I've gone back and forth a little bit, mostly feeling the same way that you have expressed, that we do have a fairly regular turnover in our legislative body. But what I do think with term limits, we can have, and here's the thing that really brought me to this point, because I'd spent 30 years or so thinking there is turnover. We do have people changing. But what I've realized in looking at my district and what I stated when I took this job is I didn't want to be in a position for 20 years which would basically short-circuit a couple of generations of individuals in my community that might want to participate in the public process at the legislative level from being able to do that. And the thing that has me thinking that we will get better candidates is that if I know that I've got a representative that the maximum time they can be in the House is 8 years, I know that I can be building time in the assembly. I can be working on nonprofit boards. I know that that seat is going to change within my working lifetime so that I can put my name forward. I can prepare to run for office. I can be ready when that time comes up, as opposed to guessing or trying to wonder when me, Sam Keto, representative, is going to leave if I'm not term limited and I end up here for 20 years. There's two and a half generations of individuals that might be wonderful legislators in my community that would then be forced to move to a different community to participate as a state representative. And so looking at it from that perspective, I felt it creates a better pool of potential candidates coming up through the ranks that will be ready to serve and will be ready to provide that public service, as opposed to somebody wanting to be interested and then maybe not getting the chance to participate.
Thank you. Representative Knopf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I've never been necessarily adamantly opposed to term limits. And matter of fact, when I was in local government, we implemented term limits. I termed out after 6 years and set out a term and was reelected to a third term. And then I made somebody mad and got elected to this one. So, while I was still in my third term, but what's different is, and so you, if we go through the discussion, first on your proposal, you bring up two issues, and that is longevity, career politicians, and you bring up citizen legislatures, which are two different issues. So if this was passed, you're not necessarily ensuring that you're getting citizen legislators in the definition you provided to us, somebody who has another career and other jobs outside of this life. So they take a break from that. They come do their public service. So if term limits were enacted, it would not ensure that we're getting what you described there. And then because in House districts, as you know, we run in every 2 years, so that really is serving the public has every opportunity. You've talked about future generations, but nothing prevents any of them from running against you at every single campaign every 2 years if they think you're doing a poor job. When we talk about the power of incumbency, there is some truth in that, but there's also truth in the fact that citizens recognize some of the experience you're building, and they value some of that experience. So you mentioned if you spent 2 years on labor and commerce and 2 years on state affairs and 2 years on education, and you got to touch on finance for 2 years, and you're really getting very well rounded, and now you're termed out. So there are good and bad in your proposals as I see them, and I don't really know which way is the right way. And then I haven't read the bill in its entirety, but we talked about setting out two terms. So if you're in the Senate and you run 8 years, and now there's a 4-year seat, so do they set out 4 years in that, I mean, or if they choose not to run for a House seat, or is it just a 2-year hiatus? Anyway, I guess, I mean, it brings concerns and it brings opportunities as well. So, just your thoughts on them.
The Chair, Representative Knopf, it seemed like we've got a few questions and kind of a general discussion, and I appreciate that. I guess the sitting out is actually 2 years, which means, and it does actually work for the Senate too, because there are situations where a Senate term on a reapportionment year is a 2-year term, and so if somebody sits out starting in say 2010, they could run again, and that seat, that particular Senate seat, could be open in 2012, and so it is just a 2-year sit out. Regarding the I lost one of your other questions. There was something about,
well, I think the really one I want to know is, as we talk about the level of experience you gain,
right.
And so I want to touch on that, if you'd respond to that. But also I just want to highlight that if you end up in the minority for 6 or 8 years and don't have the voice you really truly have, them are areas of concern if this was to pass.
So I do have, through the Chair, Representative Knopf, kind of a thought on that issue. And my predecessor was in the minority for 15 years and did not chair a committee and served her constituents very well in that role. We have many legislators that only serve 2, 4, 6 years. They are effective in the state of Alaska, as small as our state is. As a freshman majority member, I'm chairing a committee, and so definitely rapid learning, and we don't have that opportunity to grow. But that is, a situation I think that is different in Alaska than we have in many other states, in that we do have people that don't have a lot of experience that come in not as speaker in their first term, but maybe speaker in their second term, or chair of finance in their first term. I've seen that happen in the past. So with our smaller state, I do believe even the shorter serving legislators are representing their districts as well, because they have opportunities to participate in leadership. So it's really about bringing different ideas into the legislature and keeping things moving around. And it's also about public expectation, as I was responding to Representative Birch, that in my district, if there is an expectation that one individual is going to be a senator for as long as they want, or a representative for as long as they want, then you have less opportunity for other individuals that might have a desire for state service to start training themselves to participate in that state service.
Representative Wall.
I'll jump in if there's an opening. I generally do support the concept of term limits, and I think there's pros and cons to it, of course. I think it's good to get a healthy amount of turnover, and as someone who does have a job outside of the legislature, I realize it's very hard to maintain this job, and especially if it goes into 180 plus days. If you have a sort of what they call a regular job, you wouldn't be able to do it, but owning your own business certainly helps. You mentioned the average length of legislators currently, and I think around 10 or something like that. What was the year? The number of years?
Representative Wolf. For Senate, it is, let's see. For Senate, we calculated it out as 9.3 years. For House, 7.2 years.
And I'm curious if there's a, with the mean or the I know that's an average, I would guess that there's people that are here for 2 years or 4 years, and then there's people who are here for 14 years, and so the aggregate might be a 7 or 8, but and Representative Birch mentioned a lot of new people came in, but I didn't look at the stats, but my recollection is there's some people that retired that have been here for quite a while, a small handful, and I mean, it's good to have turnover, and I think largely it exists on its own with normal elections. I think some people get entrenched and will never lose unless they choose not to run. And I think it's also good to get a turnover at the leadership level so that, you know, as people are here longer and they rise to the top, that they ultimately, new people get into those positions with a different outlook. So I overall, I think it's a good idea. And if you're 8 years in the House, 8 years in the Senate, that's 16 years. That's a pretty good chunk of time. And if you want to take 2 years off and then come back, more power to you, I guess. But
yes, through the chair, Representative Wool, and just kind of more clarity, we do have, for all serving legislatures since statehood, the terms vary from 1 year to 32 years. And I can probably calculate a median. What we've given you is kind of the mean, the average.
Thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
I understand they have term limits in California. And I'm just wondering, what I've read is that quite a bit of time in California is that you'll have a senator and a representative who will keep transferring back and forth. Is my understanding correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I do not know if that is the case. I do know that California is one of two states that has a full-time legislature, so representatives in California get paid $100,000 a year and have staffs of 15 to start with. The same thing is the case in New York State. One of the other differences in California is each House or Assembly district in California represents 500,000 people. And so getting to know your district is quite a bit different in California than, say, it is as it did in Alaska. I go through my district. I could probably say that most of the people in my district, after having served for 4.5 years, would recognize me as the representative and can come up and talk to me. That would not be the case in a state such as California or New York.
Well, I guess my point was, though, is that if representatives and senators transfer back and forth, then the idea that this is going to give new people options for serving that they otherwise might not have had, that wouldn't necessarily be correct. But again, I don't know whether my understanding about California is correct. Do you think you might be able to find that out for me?
The Chair, Representative Liu, we can definitely ask, and I guess my point being that if you're representing a district of 500,000 people or a million people in terms of their Senate districts, that name recognition will be that only as opposed to understanding who the individual is. I could see that perhaps being the case. I do know that in Alaska that would be a situation that could happen. I would not think that it would be likely to happen, but at least if I was running for the House and I had an 8-year term and I got up to the end of that, people would know and they would know to be ready to be able to run for that next election.
Follow up.
Why wouldn't you think that it would be likely to happen in Alaska that the senator and the representative would switch back and forth?
Through the Chair, Representative Ledoux, because our districts are much smaller and the individuals that run for office are better known in their districts, and so as opposed to just having name recognition as a name on a ballot or somebody they see on TV, our constituent relations are important. As a representative of Anchorage, you will go back to Anchorage caucus and you will be sitting in front of a number of Anchorage residents. Those Anchorage residents get a chance to talk to you and meet you, and it's not just a very fractional percentage of the population. It is a number of people that are active in the district, and so I believe that individuals in Alaska know a little bit better who their representatives are, and I do not see that being an issue in Alaska.
Follow up.
I guess I don't understand why knowing your representatives better would result in senators and representatives not simply going back and forth if they both wanted to keep their jobs. How is the fact that Alaska has smaller districts and you know your representative or you know your senator better likely to keep them from going back and forth? In fact, I guess I would think that since everybody knows everybody, that it would be easier to go back and forth and thus much more likely to go back and forth.
The Chair, Representative Ledoux, I guess I will use my district as an example. So I'm coming up to the end of my 8 years. There will be people that likely I will be aware of or know of that are interested in running for that office. Those people may not be the senator. Maybe those people are the senator, but it becomes an open office, and those individuals can make their desires known. With a smaller population, their ability to come forward in an open election is a lot more relevant, I guess, or supportable or understandable than if it was somebody who was an unknown in a 500,000 person district. That would, I guess, be like running for governor every 4 years and going from governor to lieutenant governor and back again. California is a completely different animal than Alaska, and we always say that Alaska is unique. This is one of the areas where I think Alaska is definitely unique in a positive way.
Thank you.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on that, just looking at line on page 1, line 10, rather than saying that no person who has served as a representative for four full or partial successful terms shall again be eligible to hold that office, would you be willing to change that to hold any office?
Through the Chair, Representative Tuck, that actually can be a policy call of the legislature, that if we only want individuals to serve for 8 years and not have any other time, some states have done that. And they've placed a prohibition on serving more than that amount of time. Our state actually, as Representative Knott mentioned, in terms of a local election, you can sit out one term and come back, and many people do. We also have the ability to have a governor sit out a term and come back and serve again. So I guess when I was looking at this bill, I was looking at those circumstances in the state of Alaska, thinking that a total prohibition is not something the state of Alaska historically has supported.
And follow-up?
Follow-up.
That's not what this would do. This would just make it till you couldn't, because you still can, until at least 2 years have intervened. You can still run again, but you just can't go from House to Senate, Senate to House, House to Senate, Senate to House.
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, I guess I would be a little reluctant to tell somebody they could not run for one body or the other. So telling somebody that they can only be a House member, I think, is an undue restriction on their civil rights.
If I may, to the chair. Saying that they're going to be, I'm not understood that comment, but this would prevent what Representative Ledoux was pointing out, is someone from switching back and forth. Once you're in the legislature, you can serve either the House or the Senate, but no more than the terms allowed. And then after that, you'd have to sit out. And that would actually be kind of nice, because if you had two someone running for been in the House, they would have to take a, and they've termed out, they would have to wait for 2 years before running for a Senate seat, or vice versa.
So through the chair, Representative Tuck, I guess what you're suggesting is that there be a mandatory 2 years after an eight-year term, and then an individual could run for the House or the Senate?
Yes, that's correct.
That's a policy choice of the legislature. That's a policy choice of the legislature. It will create some awkwardness, I think, and maybe it'll work out. I haven't thought through the structural potential of what that would do with the four-year Senate seats. So if you have somebody that terms out on a four-year seat and that seat is still a four-year seat, they would not be able to run for that Senate seat, but they could run for a House seat after 2 years. And that's has potential, I suppose.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I got confused by that last exchange. So as the bill is written, an individual could serve 4 years, 8 years in the House, four terms, and then immediately do two terms in the Senate without a break. And that would be 16 consecutive years in the legislature, correct?
Through the chair, the way the bill is written, that is correct. You can go from one body to the other. If you want to run again for the same body, you have to take at least a two-year break.
How many states have, not exactly this, but overall term limits in their state legislature?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, right now there are 15 states with active term limits. They are different by state, but there are 15 states that have term limit requirements.
I guess one more point I will make that hasn't been made is that in a term limit situation where you have more, conceivably, people coming to the end of their terms, end of their limit, they may know that they can't run for re-election, so it may change how they legislate during their last term, much like a lame duck president may do stuff that they wouldn't do in their first term. So that's probably not a bad thing.
Through Chair, Representative Wool, I think that has been argued both directions, that having a lame duck incumbency means that in a presidential situation, an individual might do more edgy things or challenging things that they would not do if they were facing re-election. So in that case, it can be a positive thing. And then also people say that as an incumbent, some people might not consider your issues because all they have to do is wait a year and you won't be there. That would be, say, a negative thing. I think just as in this process, you had mentioned that there are pros and cons. We wouldn't be here if there were only cons or only pros. That's part of our job, I believe.
Thank you.
That'll be the first hearing. We'll bring this back before the community at a future date. I actually might indulge in a closing comment. I was struck by the observation that the uncertainty is often a limiting factor for people who might seek legislative office, and sort of not knowing when there might be an opening, when a seat becomes open, certainly does handicap people. And I mean, it's also, I guess, sort of running with that thought precedented that Sometimes you do have someone who retires, but with no notice at all. Sometimes it's announced the day of the filing deadline, and maybe only a handful of people know that in advance, and it doesn't necessarily empower people to sort of participate in a fully open way. That hadn't occurred to me in intersection with this. But appreciate the piece of legislation. Thank you, Representative Keto.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
And that takes us to the second item on today's agenda. Also a first hearing, HB 310 from Representative Klayman. Representative Klayman is going to be with us shortly. But for now, we have staff, Ms. Godinez. We can take a brief at ease. Going back on the record, HB 310, Representative Klayman, welcome. Please put yourself on the record and present the legislation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Matt Klayman, State Representative for House District 21. I want to thank you all for hearing House Bill 310 today. By raising the minimum marriage age in Alaska to 18, with exceptions only for emancipated minors and active military members, House Bill 310 puts an end to what the United States has denounced as human rights abuse. Marriage before the age of 18 correlates with poor life outcomes, including discontinued education, increased risk of psychiatric disorders, and increased risk of poverty. For those who were happily married at an earlier age, who are close to someone who married young, it might seem like this bill prevents young people from marrying the person that they love. In fact, the bill delays rather than prevents the unions of those looking forward to decades of happy marriage. Included in your bill packets is a table reflecting the number of state marriages involving minors between 2000 and 2015. As the table indicates, the number of minors getting married in the state is in decline, from 73 in 2000 to 17 in 2015. By asking an increasingly small number of people to wait a couple of years before getting married, we protect minors who, because of external pressure and lack of legal rights, might find themselves forced into marriages that they are later unable to leave. 70-80% of marriages involving children end in divorce, and when they do, because of limited education and work opportunities, former child brides and grooms have few options for supporting themselves and, in many cases, supporting their children. The economic burden that falls to the state in those instances. With House Bill 310, we hope to bring an end to a human rights abuse that affects not just individuals, but society as a whole. And with that, I'll turn it over to my staff, Sari Godinez, to explain the bill in greater detail.
To the chair and the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. For the record, my name is Sari Godinez, and I'm staff to Representative Klayman. The purpose of this bill is to protect children from finding themselves in lifelong commitments in which they had no say and from which they cannot escape. Under current law, Alaskan minors can't vote, serve on a jury, purchase a firearm, open a checking account on their own, file a domestic violence protective order on their own, or work without the consent of their parents. Yet they are old enough to be married with parental approval or a court ruling for those under 16. This puts a child in a particularly vulnerable situation where they could be coerced into marrying an abuser. And if the relationship is abusive, leaving their spouse may be extremely difficult. House Bill 310 amends Alaska statutes to ensure that two people are on equal legal footing before entering into marriage. Section 1 requires a person be 18 years of age or older, an emancipated minor, or a member of the armed forces on active duty in order to be married. Section 2 amends Alaska Statute 25.20.020, which relates to arrival at majority upon marriage, so that a person reaches the age of majority when they marry. Section 3 repeals Alaska Statute 25.05.171, which allows minors 16 to 18 years old to marry with parental consent, and minors 14 to 15 years old to marry with judicial approval and parental consent. And Section 4 applies this act to people married on or after the act's effective date. Thank you for hearing House Bill 310 today. With that, we're happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you. Representative Ledoux.
So it looks like there's an exception in this on line 9 for emancipated under AS0955590. What does that mean? What does emancipated under that mean?
Um, through the chair, Representative Ledoux. Emancipated means that they're 16 years of age or older, and they're living separate and apart from their parents or guardians and are able to prove that they are self-sustaining in their own financial affairs.
And
follow up.
What's involved in that proof? I mean, the reason I'm asking that is because if you're 16 years old and you want to marry your boyfriend and your parents say no, or I guess your parents wouldn't even be involved in this if this passes, why wouldn't you get yourself emancipated?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I believe that with this bill you could seek emancipation, and that would then, if they ruled that you receive emancipation, then you would be able to file for marriage. But
then isn't that a loophole which almost subsumes this bill? If you can avoid the 18 by simply getting yourself emancipated?
Representative Matt Klayman, for the difference is that to get emancipated, you actually have to have a court hearing for the judge to find that you meet the qualifications to be emancipated. And so that's the safeguard, whereas now with parental consent, you could get married without actually having shown that you can manage your own affairs.
So, how many kids under 16, for example, are married in this state each year?
To the chair, Representative Ledoux, I believe it's between 0 and 1 each year. And I would add to the previous question, I think that the idea with having someone become emancipated, if they're 16 or 17 before they can marry, is if they are emancipated, then they have most of the legal rights of an adult, which is what we're hoping to achieve with this bill, is to have people enter marriage on equal legal footing with their spouses.
So do we know of let's forget the under 16 ones, because that's to me is like a totally different category, but the 16 to the 18 year old, do we know that those folks who get married between the ages of 16 or 18, that they are married against their will? For example, I've got a friend who was married for 30 years. She was married at 17 years old. Got her parents' permission. And, I mean, she wasn't forced to marry anybody.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux. So there are many cases where people are happily married at the age of 16. What this bill is trying to do is it's asking those people to wait a couple of years so that in the rare cases where someone is forced into marriage by external pressure from their family or other parties, in those cases they would be able to prevent that marriage because they wouldn't be able to take place.
So in other words, while there are many cases of people who get married at 16 who have workable marriages, you want those people to forego marriage for 2 years because of the extremely rare incidents where somebody is forced into marriage?
The statistics that we presented show that it's very, very few people who get married at 16 and 17. And the statistics show that even those, although they may not be in abusive relationships, statistically the vast majority end in divorce, and when they're divorced, they're actually in very poor financial straits when they're divorced because they actually weren't functioning well when they got married.
Follow-up?
No follow-up.
More questions, though. And I want to keep in mind that the UA Finance Subcommittee gavels in at 4:30, so I think my intention here is allowing each member a string of questions. If the string gets too long, we'll deal with that when we get there, because there's also House Bill 152 on the agenda, and time allowing, would like to take action on that. So, Representative Ledoux, this would be your last opportunity to ask questions.
Forever?
No. On this hearing. today.
That's fine. That's
on House Bill 310. Okay, great. Moving on, Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It appears, looking at your schedule here, it appears that since 2000 to 2015, the number of 17 and under marriages have gone from 73 down to 17, and none under 15. And as a matter of fact, I think there's a notation in here somewhere that no marriages, see, the trend in marriages among minors have been downward for the last 15 years, and there's only been one in the under 16 category in the last 5 years of data. I mean, half the marriages end up in divorce anyway, right? I mean, you know, whether you're 19, 18, or 50, it seems like that, you know, that's a challenge, certainly. But one question I would have for the sponsor would be, are there any, actually a couple questions, but the first one would be, are there other states, in other words, if somebody was to go to another jurisdiction, could they become, I mean, if they're, you know, two people are, you know, infatuated with each other, can they go someplace else and basically be married there, and then would that be recognized in Alaska in this case, Chair?
You may be able to eat, you know, other states that have limited to 18.
That's not what it says.
Oh.
It's asking if you can go to another state.
Okay. I think there's two parts to your question. We do have some information about other states that have raised the marriage age to 18. In terms of the full faith and credit, under constitutional full faith and credit, I believe that you would, a marriage in Nevada, for lack of a better example, would be recognized in this state if it was legal under the laws of Nevada.
So follow up. So the question is, if it's illegal here, could they travel to Nevada or some other state where it's permissible at age 16 or older, you know, be appropriately married by that jurisdiction, return to Alaska, and hopefully live out a happy and a joyous married life thereafter?
I believe that is the case, that Alaska would be, under the full faith and credit clause of the U.S. Constitution, would need to recognize that marriage from Nevada.
Okay, so this wouldn't prevent that. Follow up, as it relates to, are there any religious, and I'm not aware of any, but are there any religious, or have you been contacted by any, are there any religious issues associated with this where, for one reason or another, an entity doesn't support this or would have, and I'm just not aware of any, but have you, in your research, would this violate any particular religious jurisdiction as far as, you know, an age 16 marriage, for instance, to the sheriff?
You're asking, are there any religions that prohibit marriage under 18? Or religions that would require
you to marry? Is there a religious exemption? I should say, maybe that's the a more appropriate way of phrasing the question. I haven't been contacted by anybody, but I just was curious if you've researched that at all.
Through the chair, Representative Birch, we haven't received any pushback from religious minorities. We do have someone online who's been dealing with passing similar legislature in other states who may be able to speak to push back in other states.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any further questions, Representative Birch? Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two questions. Page 1, line 11. I'm trying to understand that particular line. I'm not aware of anyone under the age 18 doing active military duty. So, does that happen? I'm trying to understand the purpose of that line.
Representative Knopp, through the chair, with parental consent, you can join the military at age 17. And the reason that the military exemption is there is if, say, somebody's going off to war and wanted to marry their sweetheart and got married because they're in the military, and that there is actually a fair history of people that are joining the military and getting married just before they ship off, there are certainly benefits that the military provides to spouses of service members that I think is an important factor, which is why we have the exception for military people that are active military, but can't get into the military without parental consent.
I wasn't aware, Mr. Chairman, that you could do that at 17. And then, so the last question I have is, when we're changing the words between deleting one man, one woman, going to two natural persons, and again, the man and the woman must each being deleted. We've had that conversation in the past, and I'm wondering, and the legal aspect of thing, where is that at today?
That's the reason that's the language is that that was recommended because that's what the Constitution now requires.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions, Representative Knopp? Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. you mentioned the military exemption, which I understand if a man, I guess it could be a woman, so I don't want to assume, enlists at the age of 17 with parental consent and is suddenly shipped off to war, they can marry a 16-year-old other person who is not in the military? Simply because one of them's in the military, the exemption exists for the spouse as well?
Through the chair, Representative Wolf, my understanding would be that it applies to the 17-year-old marrying someone who is an adult. But I would have to check.
Follow up.
Okay, so it says a member of the armed forces. So the member of the armed forces can be under 18. But the spouse, so a 17-year-old, I'll use the example, 17-year-old boy can marry a 21-year-old woman, but not if she's also 17 and not in the military, then this exemption would not apply, correct?
Through the chair, that's correct.
Okay.
Representative, well, if she, through the chair, if the 17-year-old who was not in the military then went and got emancipated, then that person could get married.
Follow up. What this bill does, it says you can still be emancipated, which requires a judge, the intervention of a judge, if you are 16 or 17, and for some reason or other you really want to get married. Maybe you're pregnant, and for religious reasons you don't want to be pregnant and not married or anything along those lines. The judge can interview you, and you also need parental consent or just the judge's consent?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, you need judicial approval and parental consent. There are some cases, I believe, where you don't need parental consent, but that's in extreme cases where the parents are unfit to decide the matter.
I guess I know. Last one.
Last question.
Last one, Mr. Chair. My aunt got married at 16, a long time ago. So, and I think back then it was probably more common, and nowadays, as your statistics show, it's becoming less common to get married at a younger age. So, I guess it all makes sense. The military exemption, shipping off to war, seems also a little dated, but not to say it doesn't happen, but you know, you could argue that for other shipping off too. But
thank you for that question, Representative Wall.
Well, it wasn't a, yeah.
No, I appreciate it. Representative Tuck, last in line.
Thank you. On your child marriage in America executive summary, I see some terms that are being interchanged, and I just needed to see what the definitions are, because I see minors, I see children, I see adults. So I'm just curious, when you use the term minors in this, are you talking about someone under the age of 21? Because I also see, like, I see the number of minors getting married in Alaska is in decline, and then you go on to say that 77 children were married in 2000. I'm just trying to figure out where is the definition, the point of demarcation between children and minors, or minors and adults, or children and adults?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, I believe children and minors are being used interchangeably in this executive summary, and that it refers to people under the age of 18.
Okay, so between 18 and 21 is not a minor in this term.
Through the chair, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tuck. Any further questions? Okay, we will hold this bill. Although, before we do, public testimony was noticed. I should note that there's no one on. Oh, there is one person online for public testimony, and I'll also take testimony from the room if there is anyone. Jean Smoot with the Justice Center in Washington, D.C., the first name of which I'm sure I will mispronounce. If you can hear us, please put yourself on the record and present your testimony in two or less minutes.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Chair, Vice Chair, and committee members, for the honor of addressing you today. My name is Jeannie Smoot, and I'm the Senior Policy Counsel at the Tahrir Justice Center. We're a 20-year-old national legal services organization that works with survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, and other violence and abuse, including forced marriages. And we understand through our work that forced marriages can involve insidious forms of coercion, so not only physical violence, but also extreme psychological abuse and threats. And when that comes from a parent or other loved one, it can work just like a gun to the head or a shotgun wedding example for a teen girl who's still very dependent on her family, both emotionally and practically. So we run across the country a special forced marriage initiative, and over the last several years, we've worked on over 500 cases involving women and girls across the U.S., We've also analyzed all 50 states' minimum marriage age laws and exceptions and released a detailed report on how the current laws can actually facilitate, unfortunately, forced marriages and other abuse and exploitation in the guise of marriage. And so based on all that work, I want to flag just a few of the concerns that Alaska's current law poses in terms of serious child protection risks. The parental consent exception can actually conceal parental coercion. So, unfortunately, among our forced marriage cases, most often the perpetrator is a parent. And there are, for many reasons, this happens. But sometimes it's because a parent just wants to be rid of any more responsibility for a girl and to offload her on whoever will take her. So whatever the background, the common vulnerability is that children lack the legal rights and resources an adult would need to stand up for themselves and get to safety. You've mentioned, of course, that the low age of 14 falls even below the state's legal age of consent to sex, and combined with the affirmative defense to prosecution for statutory rape that's in Alaska statute, that means that as long as the parties are married, you've essentially roadmapped a workaround for predators to access young girls that would otherwise be off limits. Third concern I want to flag is that only a relative handful of the minors currently being married ever see a judge. And in any event, that approval process has only vague and subjective criteria and doesn't have other critical safeguards like court-appointed counsel for the minor. So unfortunately, for these and other reasons, Alaska's current laws make it far too easy for a host of horrors, ones that we see every day, to lurk behind the marriage of an underage girl, no questions asked. And so that is the crux of the problem with current law. And if we had more time, I'd share with you some of those direct stories that show that we actually don't know the overlap or how many of these cases, these statistics, are forced marriages of children. But based on our work and the vulnerabilities we see, we're very concerned that precisely because the kids still marrying today are marrying against national trends, that they represent particularly vulnerable children who have no say in the matter and whose parents or partners are not listening to them.
And Ms. Smoot, would you be able to summarize your testimony?
Yes, I can just tell, in terms of the national picture, this year alone, 15 states have taken up reform bills, 8 more on the horizon. In Virginia, which has passed a similar law limiting marriage to legal adults, the year before the new law, 182 minors were married, including one younger than 15. In 2017, the year...
And Ms. Smoot, thank you for your public testimony, just in light of the time that we have in this committee, and with one more piece of legislation and testimony in the room, we're going to need to move on.
Thank you.
At this time, I'd like to open public testimony to anyone in the room who is here to testify. And I believe there was a testimony sheet outside, and there were some names down, although no names marked for public testimony. So if anyone is here to testify on HB 310, please come forward.
And Mr. Chair, I just was going to ask if the previous testifier can give her testimony in written.
Absolutely, yeah.
So we can hear the rest of it. Thank you.
That would be appreciated. Is anyone here to testify on HB 310? No. Okay, well, seeing no one, I'm going to close public testimony. And that takes the bill back before the committee. Thank you. As a first hearing, appreciate the introduction of the bill, and we'll certainly bring it back and set aside as much time as is necessary to hash out any additional issues But thank you, Representative Clayman. All right, that takes us to the third item on today's agenda, HB 152. And our old friend,
she's got a youthful spirit.
Yes, she's got a youthful spirit. Hello, Ms. Kloster. Thanks for joining us. This is the fourth hearing on this piece of legislation. It's my understanding there's a CS. Actually, maybe just open with a motion, and I can object for purposes of discussion. Vice Chair?
Yes, I move to adopt 30-LSO366R as the working document.
I will object. Ms. Kloster, could you please speak to the CS?
The record, Kendra Kloster, staff to Representative Tuck. Nice to see you all again. Getting used to being here. The CS in front of you removed the imminent response authority. This was the language I was allowing the Adjutant General to call the Guard to duty if the governor is unavailable. When visiting with members after our hearings, this was kind of the sticking point. So what we did is went ahead and removed those sections of the bill, and so the rest of the CS in the CS before you, the rest of the language regarding command, control, the tag accepting resignations and retirement, and the Alaska State Defense Force and Naval Militia, adding them to the tuition program.
Thank you. Any questions? Wow. Peaceable committee. Okay, I'm going to remove my objection. Is there any further objection to the CS? Seeing none, the CS for HB 152 is adopted. There were no amendments submitted for the piece of legislation. Any committee comments at this time? Representative Ledoux.
It solved my problem, the CS.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It solved my problem as well, and I just want to add, my aunt who got married at 16 also got married four more times after that, so I don't think it really worked.
Thank you for that piece of family history.
I just want to leave you all hanging.
Representative Tuck.
Give that woman term limits. No, just joking.
Any other comments?
On a serious note with this bill, we should try to figure out a way that in case there's imminent danger to the state of Alaska, whether it's a natural disaster or other, that we find a way, and the governor is incapacitated in any way, or the lieutenant governor, or both, and we just simply get a hold of them, that we have a way of quickly reacting. Because we know it's a lengthy process to first designate that a governor is incapacitated and then have to swear in a lieutenant governor before action can be taken with our military as a form of safety. I understand that there's been problems with that currently, but let's just start thinking about that in the future. And so this bill eliminates that for now. But just in case we come up with a better plan, you know, think it through. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further comments from the committee? Madam Vice Chair.
Yes, I move HB 152 version 30-LSO366-R from committee as amended with individual recommendations and accompanying zero fiscal note.
Seeing and hearing no objection, HB 152 moves from committee. Thank you, Ms. Kloster, Representative Tuck. I want to speak quickly to next week's agenda, which has been noticed. On Tuesday, we have a confirmation hearing for Commissioner Valerie Davidson for her position as successor to Lieutenant Governor Malott, should anything happen. First hearings on HCR 22 from Representative Millett, Sexual Assault Awareness Month. First hearing on HDR 38 on the Alaska Railroad from Representative Kopp. Public testimony on HB 184 and HCR 1 from Representative Josephson. And I will be gone on Thursday, but the committee will continue with Vice Chair Ledoux and a number of pieces of legislation scheduled for that day as well, and we'll be back to a 3:15 to 5:15 schedule with finance subcommittees closed out. With that and no further business before the committee, we are adjourned at 4:24 p.m.